Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2012, a program manager at Microsoft named Karen Chang decided to learn how to dance. So she started practicing and filmed her progress every day for 1 year. From those first clumsy frames to her last really impressive display on day 365, Karen collected the footage in a time-lapse video that beautifully illustrates what a difference a year can make. That video has now been viewed more than 3 million times, has landed Karen on a number of primetime TV shows, and become the inspiration for her new project called Give It 100. Karen Chang, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Virginia.
So you say the process of filming yourself dancing every day helped you stick with it and to see your own progress. Why do you think it made such a difference?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. The first one is when you watch yourself back, you see things that you can't necessarily catch in the mirror. And that goes for a lot of things, not just dance, sports, for example, musical instruments. But then the other thing is that you are able to see yourself progress in a way that you wouldn't otherwise. And I think, you know, it's kind of like a child when you're growing. You don't really know that you're growing until, like, your aunt sees you every like year or so and says, oh my gosh, you've gotten so big. And it's really the same thing when you're learning. You never notice when you're getting better. But then when you watch your videos from a month or 3 months or a year ago, then that's when you realize, wow, I have really improved.
So that became the seed for Give It 100. How can people participate in that?
So you go to giveit100.com and you choose something that you want to get better at and you agree to practice it for 100 days. And then you just share a video of you practicing it for 10 seconds every day. And you'll post that video and you'll see other people doing the same thing and you give each other encouragement and it helps you keep going.
And the website does advise new people signing up for Give It 100 not to aim to make the perfect video. Why not?
Well, you could make the perfect video but on day one, but then how much progress would you see on day 100? And so if you show your mistakes, you'll be able to look back on what was the true you. You know, on the internet, on YouTube and on Facebook, there is so much pressure for everyone to kind of bring their best selves mm-hmm. and to kind of show like a perfectly glossy version of your life and put an Instagram filter on like whatever, you know, scenic view you see today. And Give It 100 is really the place for you to share the raw underbelly and your mistakes. And when you're juggling, it failing. And when you're trying to do a handstand, you falling. And we really encourage that because, you know, perfect is boring. I think mistakes are a lot more interesting.
Looking through all of the projects on Give It 100, some that may sound mundane are surprisingly inspirational. I'm thinking of this guy, Jason. He recorded himself trying to touch his toes every day until finally doing it.
Yes.
How does sharing in other people's success help motivate us, do you think, Karen?
Well, I think it's wonderful that, so Jason, he's trying to touch his toes, and you see him getting closer, inching closer and closer and closer every day. And for a lot of people, this is a silly challenge. But for many people, they see the video, which now I posted it yesterday, now has 20,000 views, is, oh, this is like such a simple little thing that I could never do, that I just assumed I couldn't do. But then here's this, like, the most inflexible guy I've ever seen, you know, working at it day after day. And sure enough, on day 40, he can do it. And I think it's just so compelling to see people when they can't do it yet, working hard at it, struggling at it, and eventually getting it. And I think it's just a reminder that like everything that we see, every talented person that we see at some point started a beginner.
Well, there were some projects that really surprised me as well, like trying to find a man. Not hitting the snooze button was another one. Or training my cat to use a human toilet.
Yeah, really excited about the training cat to use a human toilet. And I can't wait to see that cat like using a human toilet on day, you know, 50 or whatever.
Any other great surprises for you seeing the creative ways people are using the Give It 100 platform?
I think the biggest surprise has been the community that's developed because, you know, when we had the idea for Give It 100, it was literally me looking at my dance practice footage thinking, oh, you know, it would be a more easy way to look at all those footage if it was organized like this. And so I wasn't thinking at all about the, I guess, the community aspect of it. But what we see happening is, you know, you log on every day and you share a video of you trying your best and probably making a bunch of mistakes along the way. And you see other people every single day struggling and working towards something. And there's really a sense of, there's a bond that forms when everyone is pretty much working towards the same thing, which is bettering themselves. And I think the surprising thing for me is just sometimes the overwhelming, like, positive emotion that I feel from going on the website, and I just feel so uplifted. And, you know, I wasn't expecting that, but I guess it makes sense now thinking about it.
Karen Chang, I want to thank you for inspiring us and for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Karen Chang, founder of Give It 100. You can find them at giveit100.com. It's a startup aimed at helping people try things by recording and sharing their progress for others. And there is more about Give It 100 and Karen Chang at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, there's another week of sub-freezing temperatures predicted here in the Northeast. So one activity you might consider devoting 100 days to is ice skating. Pond hockey has been a favorite winter activity for many hardy New Englanders since 1883. That's when the first hockey game ever played in the United States happened on the ponds at St. Paul's School, right here in Concord, New Hampshire. The chilly tradition continued this past weekend when nearly 80 teams played at the fourth annual Black Ice Pond Hockey Championship at White Park in Concord. Producer Zach Nugent took in the sights, sounds, and a few hot chocolates at the tournament and sent us this audio postcard.
I'm watching my wife Amy play today. She's on the Galoots. We've only got a minute here left in this one. Doesn't look, not looking too good right now for them, though.
Well, it's just a great community event. It raises money for local causes, and I'm a local hockey coach with Concord Youth Hockey, so it's a great cause to bring money to the community and promote skating and hockey throughout the city.
On the Bank Chevrolet, rink number 4 at 3:40, it's the Cheers Chiefs taking on my favorite team, We Walk to White.
My husband is playing in the tournament.
Doing well?
Not so well this year. A third loss in a row.
How's he taking it?
He's taking it pretty well. Yeah, they just are having a good time.
Well, I grew up playing hockey, so I grew up in New Hampshire, and you know, hockey's been in my blood. Once it gets in your blood, it's hard to get it out, and it's a fun sport, something I do with my kids, and it's a great family event.
1 minute to go in the game. 1 minute to go.
I just like how it's a sort of organic thing to New Hampshire, that people could just go, and in our town, you know, people of all ages and skill abilities go and play hockey on the pond, and it's, you know, not super organized like so many other sports.
My favorite part is seeing them foul each other, because it's just fun to watch it, you know.
See them hip check each other and kill each other.
It's outdoors, it's fresh air, it's fabulous.
Well, it's nice when you see something that's not checking, it's just a puck handling as far as that goes and skating.
Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Bon Jovi on Rick 8. They did not get shut out. Put your hands together on Rick 8. 13-2. Big, big night for Bon Jovi.
Actually, a friend of ours who played the first year and hasn't played since, we just kind of threw out a bunch of ideas, and he came up with Bon Jovi, and we just said, that's the one. The tournament's going well. My team is 1-2, but we've got one more game, and it should be a good match.
I have multiple duties here. One is I'm the announcer. I make sure that the teams are on the ice when they need to be on the ice. I keep the schedule. I make sure that everybody's ready to go on time. We keep the tournament on time. But most of all, I might be the entertainment, trying to keep things light and fresh here at White Park.
Crew team, they've been dealing with the chaos of the sweatpants sale over here at the Souvenir Trailer.
Oh, favorite part of the tournament, and I truly mean this. I'm a North End guy. I'm a White Spark guy. I love to see White Spark and Concord come alive again. It's an annual event. We are 89 teams strong. We have 35 teams on the waiting list. And it's kind of hard to describe, but everybody's competitive, but yet they're really here to have a good time and enjoy themselves.
Sometimes, you know, I think of yesterday.
Yesterday.
We skated on the pond down by the bay.
By the bay.
Played hockey till the sun, she went away.
She went away.
Could see the puck no more, but still we play.
Thanks to producer Zach Nugent for that piece, and thank you to all the spectators, players, and organizers who spoke with him. Coming up, from the Hookman to Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, scary stories have been passed around pretty much since the dawn of the campfire. Up next, we're going to go beyond sleepover camp to the latest venue for creepy tales, the internet. That's when Word of Mouth continues. Please stay with us.
Our heroes just the same.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The telling of this scary story is as old as the campfire. Now they've made the jump from summer camp and slumber parties to the web. The internet's hunger for new, shareable content has sped up production of scary stories and urban legends. A bewildering number of web forums, message boards, and specialty websites are dedicated to sharing stories that have been passed around so often that nobody really knows where they came from, and which maybe, possibly, could be true. The genre is called creepypasta, a seemingly silly name for some of the scariest stuff on the web. And our guest, Will Wiles, wrote about creepypasta, what he calls a sort of folk literature of the web. We read his article in Eon Magazine. Will Wiles, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello.
We have to get this out of the way. Where did this name creepypasta come from?
Well, it derives from a more general term, copypasta, which just comes from the words copy and paste, meaning any short piece of text or image that is copied and pasted around web forums and shared widely without necessarily being attributed to an author or a point of origin.
Where are some of the places that you can find creepypasta online?
Well, there are dedicated sites like the Creepypasta Wiki and creepypasta.com. They're also shared on more general forums such as Reddit and 4chan. But, Google will pull up anything. Tumblr has got creepypasta sites as well.
So what might be an example? There's one that you wrote about called The Unbranded Laptop. What happens in this story?
The Unbranded Laptop is a longer one. They tend to be quite short, and it's particularly creepy. A man finds a laptop in the basement of a new house. No markings on it. It seems to be slightly damaged, but when he opens it up, it works. There's very little on it, but he discovers that the previous owner was a little girl, and creepily, he can see recordings of the previous owner using the laptop, apparently playing games on it. Something was recording her, and he finds himself unable to stop watching these recordings, which steadily develop a much more dark tone. And it's suggested at the end that he may be merely the latest in a line of people to have fallen foul of the laptop, which, as I say in the piece, is essentially a sort of cursed artifact story, which is hundreds of years old, but with modern technology, which makes it very interesting.
The more a story gets shared, the more shrouded in mystery it becomes. What's that playing into for us as humans who love these kind of stories?
Well, scary stories serve a useful social purpose. They let us know which fears we have are commonly held, and we know that other people share our fears, which is, inherently reassuring, even if the telling of the story is very scary. As you mentioned, the campfire is a social experience, not a private one. So, there's always been great value to fright. Retrospectively, it stands to reason that this would be ported into the internet age.
This has become quite a phenomenon with sites like Creepypasta, extremely popular. The site does receive thousands of scary stories whenever there is a call for submissions. So who's doing the calling and who's doing the writing here?
Well, I mean, the marvelous thing about it is that it's all enthusiasts. It seems to be genuinely grassroots effort. It could be anyone. You get a real sense of there being very few barriers to entry, to submission.
But what does that mean for the quality of the stories?
Well, like anything on the internet, it varies extremely widely. I mean, and the majority are pretty poor. there's a particular kind of very famous story or even a genre of stories because creepypasta invites imitation. But anyway, one of these popular stories is called Jeff the Killer, which seems to me to be rather unoriginal and violent. And yet it's extremely popular, so there must be something to it.
What's the story?
But it's about a psychopathic child being spared the attentions of a killer and then becoming a killer, I believe.
There are a number of subgenres within the creepypasta world, apparently. You found a number of urban legends. Maybe give us a little overview or synopsis of some of them. And why the urban legend works so well on creepypasta?
Well, I mean, the reason I discovered creepypasta was I'm looking into urban legends. I was trying to find the origin of a particular urban legend. And I discovered that essentially creepypasta was a way of sort of mass-producing urban legends. It was as if the desire for urban legends on the internet, the readership for them, had exhausted the available supply. And they were having to be kind of mass-produced. You know, people were, you know, deliberately creating them and then sharing them. There's a lot of haunted software stories along the lines of branded laptop. There's a lot of quite basic sort of hack-and-slash killer stories along the lines of Jeff the Killer. There are some quite clever twist stories, there's one called Portraits, where a man is in the woods at night and is forced to take shelter in a cabin. And the walls of the cabin are lined with horrible portraits of these semi-human creatures. Their faces twisted into rage. And nevertheless, he gets some sleep. And the next morning, he wakes up and discovers that there aren't any pictures on the wall, just windows. That's a kind of, you know, slightly Twilight Zone-y kind of twist at the end, which is a lot of the stories try and produce.
Will Wiles is with us. He generally writes about architecture and design and is the author of one published novel, one upcoming. But in this case, we're talking with him about creepypasta. This is the internet phenomenon of sharing really, really scary, apocryphal stories, sort of, as he says, like what we look at as folk literature today, passed around on the World Wide Web. Another story that you featured in your article is called Bad Dreams. Tell us about that one. It's really scary.
Well, Bad Dreams is an excellent example of creepypasta because it's pretty effective as a scary story, but also it's extremely short. And the key sort of point about creepypasta is it's there to share. It's there to be passed around, transferred from site to site and so on. That's the measure of success. And so shorter creepypastas are, you know, more likely to be successful. And this is kind of like the best short one I could find. And it's only five lines long. It begins, Daddy, I had a bad dream.
I had a bad dream.
You blink your eyes and pull up on your elbows. Your clock glows red in the darkness. It's 3:23.
Oh, sorry, honey. It's going to be okay. You want to come up on the bed and tell me about your bad dream?
No, Daddy.
The oddness of the situation wakes you up more fully. You can barely make out your daughter's pale form in the darkness of your room.
Why not, sweetie?
Because in my dream, when I told you about the dream, the thing wearing Mommy's skin sat up.
For a moment, you feel paralyzed. You can't take your eyes off your daughter. The covers behind you begin to shift.
That is a creepy story.
That's all, which is really quite. I mean, as a sort of like literary, as a sort of literary effort, that's really effective. You know, I mean, writing a short story, I mean, a very short story, requires a lot of skill. It's really excellent.
You point out that this is a leaderless, authorless movement. What do you think is the motivation then to write these stories if one is not getting any acknowledgement?
Well, there is acknowledgement. I mean, on the sites dedicated to creepypasta and so on, people are sharing stories, talking about each other's stories. You know, there's you know, food for the ego there, the authorial ego. What's just interesting there is the fact that the stories are, if they're successful, they're shared, and in sharing, often their origin is lost, and so the measure of success is to become kind of forgotten as the author, if you see what I mean. You want to kind of have your stories if it comes from nowhere. And people are sharing it as an apocryphal bit of lore, not as this is a story written by, you know, X.
Is Gary different in the digital age than it was before?
Well, the props are certainly different. I mean, you know, these stories that are often bang up to date in terms of their technology, you know, they're to do with Wi-Fi, they're to do with laptops, they're to do with social networks, you know, Google Maps. But often their concerns are perennial, to do with fears of possession, fears of ancestral evil, that kind of thing, which could come out of, you know, the ghost stories of the 19th century or the Gothic novels of the 18th century or folklore or myth. So in many ways, these stories give absolutely up-to-the-minute form to ancient fears.
Well, Will Wiles, thank you for the primer on creepypasta.
My pleasure.
Will Wiles wrote about the crowdsourced horror story website Creepypasta for Aeon Magazine. He's also the author of two novels, one, The Care of Wooden Floors, and The Way In, which is out later this year. For more information on his books and to read his Creepypasta article, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. Now stay with us as we continue our series, Rethink 2014, with a look into the design and surprising beauty of one of life's most mundane activities, waiting in line. That's when word of mouth continues. And don't worry, you won't have long to wait. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
The American economy.
Climate change without.
Hacking.
Different religions in it.
Sustainability.
Social media.
Security. Freedom.
Technology.
Marriage.
Essentially ethics.
Privacy.
Throughout the month of January, Rethink 2014 has been a forum for challenging our assumptions and habits and approaches to big concepts like relationships, environmental conservation, and poverty. Today, we aim for something a bit more mundane, perhaps the most mundane of activities, waiting in line. It's a necessary dread we all endure at the DMV, the supermarket, or airport security. The radio show 99% Invisible brings us a fresh perspective and the complicated mathematics of the queue.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. In the U.S., they're called lines. In Canada, apparently they're called lineups sometimes.
And I was once interviewed live on Canadian national radio, and they started talking about lineups, and we had a conversation about police for 5 minutes until I realized what they were talking about.
But pretty much everywhere else, it's known as a queue.
I like queue the best.
Yeah, me too.
That's Benjamin Walker. He's obsessed with queues. He keeps sending me emails with links to YouTube videos of queues.
You have psychology students filming their surreptitious queue experiments. You have Asian road rage videos. You've got people filming fights that break out in queues.
Unless you're going to physically move me, nothing's going to happen. So understand that I'm not getting out of this line.
And you can
understand that none of you are going to stop me from being in this line.
I like to call YouTube the queue hole. And when I found this lecture by Dr. Q, I immediately made an appointment to go and see him.
I'm Dick Larson. I'm a professor at MIT, and I guess my nickname is Dr. Q.
Dick Larson is a Q theorist.
Just about every day we experience queuing in some aspect of our lives.
Dick Larson studies the mathematical and psychological models of queuing systems.
Unfortunately, oftentimes too many queues on a day-to-day basis.
Dr. Q is able to put his professional knowledge to work everywhere he goes.
I have my own ways through supermarkets, particularly if you have to go to the deli counter and get a number. You run to the deli counter as soon as you go into the supermarket, get your number, and then you start walking around and doing the regular shopping, and you watch how the numbers go drop down. And then as soon as it gets close to yours, then you go back. So that's a queue that's been avoided because it's a queue within a queue. So I have little ideas like this.
Dr. Q hates waiting in line as much as you and I do. But he does respect the well-designed queue.
The Machiavellian experts of queue design are people at Disney World and the Disney properties. They have mastered the idea that people can be happy waiting 40 minutes in line for a four-minute ride. I think it's fantastic.
Disney is very serious about queue design.
They employ about 18 or so operations researchers. They call them Imagineers.
These Imagineers have mastered the golden rules of queue design.
The first is to keep your customers entertained while they wait in line.
Their guests think that the amusement has started before they actually sit on the ride.
They'll have video screens along the queue route with games. And if the lines are getting really ugly, a park manager will send in a sweaty man in a full body costume.
And so they're entertained and they're amused while they're waiting in line.
The second rule, manage expectations.
Always manage your expectations such that you'll deliver above the performance you say. So, for instance, if the line says you can anticipate 45-minute wait for if the line is out to this point, when really it might be only 35 minutes. So therefore, if you look at your watch, in 35 minutes you're getting on the line, and the dad and the mom and the two kids say, hey, we're 10 minutes ahead of schedule. So that's great. You waited 35 minutes, and you say, we just saved 10 minutes because we thought we were going to have to wait for 45 minutes.
Queue theory is about 100 years old now, but it wasn't until the 1950s that the profession really came into its own.
After World War II, there was a burst of economic activity, a lot more high-rise buildings, high-rise hotels and offices, and all of a sudden, owners of these buildings were getting complaints about rush hour delays for elevators. In those days, of course, they didn't have microprocessors to optimize the movement of the elevators. Many of the elevators actually had humans as operators, as pilots, so to speak. So Russ Acuff, who was a professor at University of Pennsylvania, sent one of his research aides to New York City to check out these complaints about elevator delays. And indeed, he found out that there were rush hours for elevators.
Like 8 to 9 in the morning or 5 to 6 at night, just like rush hour for cars.
So he said, the traditional engineering approach, dynamite this building and start over again with twice as many elevator shafts because you've got more demand than you have capacity at these rush hours.
In my experience, engineers are a lot more crafty than that, but let's just go with it.
But then, in a stroke of genius, he said, well, maybe the problem is framed the wrong way. Maybe the problem isn't the 90 seconds of wait for the elevators. Maybe the problem is the complaints about the 90-second waits for the elevators. And if we could reduce the complaints substantially, maybe we'll solve the problem. And then in another stroke of genius, he said, well, what if you give somebody a distraction, a diversion? Let's try floor-to-ceiling mirrors next to all the elevators in an experimental building. So you got the money, put the mirrors in. Watched for a month, and guess what? The complaints dropped to near zero. Men who were wearing ties could adjust their ties. Women could make sure their hair was organized okay.
Or vice versa.
Sometimes men and women were even seen to flirt occasionally through the reflection. I guess it's less provocative than eye-to-eye contact. The complaints dropped to near zero. Problem solved. The statistics of the delay unchanged. Ingenious.
Mirrors won't work at McDonald's or Whole Foods, though. Many fast food restaurants and most grocery stores use parallel queues, where there's a bunch of open lanes and you're forced to pick one and stick with it. The one next to you could be going faster for any number of reasons, and it's totally frustrating, but you stay in your line and you play the hand you're dealt.
But there's another way to do it. A single serpentine line that feeds all of the open registers. It's first come, first served. It's a queue designed for equality and fairness. And when there's one line, both blatant and inadvertent queue jumping is minimized.
We call them slips and skips.
And American companies, they used to pride themselves on designing these more egalitarian queues.
Wendy's is very proud that they're the first ones in fast food that had the single serpentine line. American Airlines is very proud. They claim that they're the first ones to have single serpentine line in airports, although British Air argues with them. They say, well, they got it at the same time. There used to be a bank in New York called Chemical Bank, and they used to claim that they were the first ones to have that in their bank lobbies. And so there's a certain pride to getting rid of inadvertent line jumping by slips and skips by having the single serpentine line.
But today, queue design is changing. More and more, we're encountering queues that are designed so that different levels of service can be provided to different groups of people.
Priority queues and giving certain people priorities over others, you can see it in amusements like Disney, but more seriously, it occurs in some life and death situations like queuing for organ donation transplants.
My hypothesis is that this design change is connected to the queue rage that's becoming more and more commonplace and available to watch for free on YouTube. And I also believe that understanding this new queue theory will better help us understand the inequality and disparity that's on the rise in this country.
Yeah, you might say, well, why should somebody with a lot of frequent flyer miles get automatically bumped up to first class? As I found out, I recently was on some flights, and therefore can escape the TSA queue for in airports. And I feel a little bit guilty about that. And just yesterday, I did this twice. And I felt a little bit guilty because there were like 30 people in line, and I went right to the front of it. And I thought, why is this fair? Just because I fly a little bit more than the others do. And so I think your question is a deep one and requires some more thought and discussion.
Roman Mars there and his wonderful creation, 99% Invisible. You'll find a link to the radio show and the podcast at wordofmouthradio.org. We just heard a little bit about the pains of waiting on queue, and now to a fun story about being in line. Tina Foster is a line dancing instructor in Southern Maine. She spoke to radio producer Morgan McCarthy about the difficulties and joys of teaching line dancing.
The first time that you come in, you're going to walk out of here with absolutely nothing but a bunch of jumble in your head.
5, 6, 7, and walk. Right, walk. Left in a kickball change. Walk, walk, after. Walk, walk, kickball change. Walk, walk, after.
I'm Tina Foster. I am a line dance instructor in Southern Maine. I was a former corporate accountant and got laid off from my job. And my husband said, go make your dance full time. So that's what I do full time now.
Angela, you can do this one, honey. Come on out here. Step touches.
If you can count to 8 and you know your left from your right, you're halfway there. The rest of it is stick-to-itiveness. You just have to keep on plugging at it. You just can't say, nope, can't do it. You need to keep trying. I've taught some of the most uncoordinated people in the world how to line dance. As everyone goes along, they learn the step, and then they'll learn the modifications of that step. Oh, yeah, there's a dance called the Tush Push, and that's good old country music. You can go anywhere in the world and go line dancing, and if they call the Tush Push, you can go dance it because it's the same thing everywhere you go. Line dancing, when you're line dancing, there are no mistakes in line dancing. If you go in the wrong direction, we call it a variation. Unless you use some operative words out of your mouth that tell us you made a mistake. Nobody needs to know. You just keep on going. That's what fake it till you make it's all about. You just keep faking the dance until you actually have it and you don't have to think about it anymore. It just kind of teaches you that it's okay to have your own life and to do something you enjoy, even if it's only a couple of hours a week.
Morgan McCarthy speaking with line dancing instructor Tina Foster. Now stay with us for the curious case of Richard III's remains. His short reign ended in the 15th century, but the battle over where he should be buried is just beginning to rage. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. William Shakespeare's Richard III opens with the would-be king uttering these famous lines.
Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York.
The play chronicles Richard III's Machiavellian rise to power and short reign in the 15th century. King Richard III held the throne for only 2 years, but his legacy has captured the British imagination for centuries. First in the play, and now in the courts, as evidenced by a lawsuit swirling around the discovery of Richard's remains in 2012. Sam Knight wrote about the battle over where the bones of Richard III should be buried for Prospect magazine and joins us on the phone from London. Sam Knight, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start with the body. Richard III's remains discovered under a parking lot in Leicester, England in 2012, confirmed to be his in February 2013. How did they know it was him?
So it's a funny story, as with a lot of this kind of whole saga, but actually a few years earlier, a different group of scientists had been trying to identify some old bones in Belgium. And because the kind of European royal families were all sort of related back at that time, they did a lot of DNA work around the sort of ruling house in that part of Europe. And one of those relations happened to be very closely related to Richard. So it just happened that they sort of had the DNA on file. So that kind of existed somewhere. And so when they found this body, it was sort of relatively straightforward to look at those bones and then to compare them to a very closely matching set of DNA.
This was not your typical archaeological dig. Who were the players involved with making this happen?
What's actually very important in the lawsuit now was that this wasn't an archaeological dig led by a group of scientists with a theory. The exact location of Richard's remains had been an object of kind of debate and scrutiny for some time. And in 2004, a woman called Philippa Langley, who is a screenwriter and who's very keen to make a big film about Richard III, was doing some research, and so she visited the scene of the Battle of Bosworth, where he died in 1485, and was trying to follow various rumours about where his bones had ended up. And she ended up in this car park in Leicester in the summer of 2004 on the site of an old monastery where his bones were said to have been left, but then thrown out a couple of hundred years later. But she was walking through this car park, and she described a strange physical sensation came over her body as she went through this car park, and she became convinced that Richard's body had not actually been thrown out, but was still there under this car park. And that sort of led to an amazing 8-year campaign by Philippa, getting in touch with these DNA experts, raising money, hassling the city of Leicester, asking the University of Leicester if they were interested to take it on. And she really knocked on every door you could possibly think of until, in the summer of 2012, funded about 50% by enthusiasts and people like her, and the rest taken up by the University of Leicester and the city. They conducted this very small archaeological dig, which hit pay dirt immediately on exactly the spot where she said that they would find the bones. So there's this amazing streak of enthusiasm and amateurism and, kind of, you hesitate to say the word, but sort of magic has gone into this story for a long time.
It really is an amazing story. And among the passionate that she enlisted were the Richard III Society. Who is the Richard III Society? What is its mission?
I know, it's a real oddity. I don't think I've ever come across a society quite like it, but the Richard III Society was founded in the 1920s in England to restore the reputation of Richard III, which sort of seems like such a quixotic aim for a society. But Richard had got this terrible reputation, a picture kind of that most of us know, at least in this country, from Shakespeare, of this Machiavellian character, happy to murder members of his own family to secure his hold on the English crown, disposing of his wife, his nephews, anyone who gets in his way. Starting in about the 18th century, you store, I don't know, it's hard to describe, disparate group of people who became devoted to trying to restore some balance to that story and to restore Richard's good name as they saw it. And this led to the forming of this strange society in the 1920s, which has sort of carried on its work in the shadows, really, for, you know, 80 or 90 years, leading research, funding historical research into Richard's reign, trying to achieve what they think of as this more balanced interpretation of the man and his times. Philippa Langley was the Scottish secretary of the Richard III Society.
These are the people also called the Ricardians. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's right. There's a sort of overlap between the Richard III Society, which is the largest organization of Ricardians, as they call themselves. And a Ricardian is someone who kind of believes that Richard wasn't as bad as everyone made him out to be.
After this kind of miraculous discovery, the trouble starts. So who are the parties vying for his remains, and what do they want done with them?
They find the body in September 2012, and they spend about the University of Leicester's archaeological department, who've teamed up with the Richard III Society to carry out the dig, then spend about 5 months doing the hard scientific legwork to actually conclude authoritatively that this was Richard III. And I think during this period, there's this kind of outpouring of joy and excitement. I mean, Richard III really is this, he's kind of a medieval celebrity, if you know what I mean. People just know him. If you grow up in England, you just grow up at school learning about Richard III. And so there's a kind of disbelief almost that this person who had gone in every physical way was suddenly back in our lives in the form of this skeleton. And it was a very kind of exciting period. It was all over the papers, all over the TV and stuff like that. And then in spring last year, you started to notice some cracks. People within the Ricardian movement had certain hopes. They always dreamed of finding Richard again, and now here was an opportunity to give him a full state funeral or to bury him in York, which was the city that he loved and spent a lot of time in during his reign. To be honest, quite romantic notions about what should be done with their hero. And then against that, you had the University of Leicester, who was really the group of very serious scientists and historians who felt strongly, and in accordance with rather arcane corners of English law, that he should be buried near to where he had been found. And then you had probably about 6 or 7 rival claims from different parts of the country or different groups of people who thought that Richard should end up in different places. Just to give you a few examples, Richard was a Catholic, so should he end up in a Catholic cathedral? His wife was buried at Westminster Abbey, so should he be in London? Should the Queen decide? All sorts of different theories and sort of arguments sprung up in the first half of last year.
This is a heated case right now in the UK. It's made it to the courts. What is actually on trial, Sam?
Well, what it is a new group of Ricardians have sprung up out of nowhere, claiming to be long-lost relatives of Richard III, and they are suing the government for giving the license to the University of Leicester to bury him in Leicester. And they're sort of asking for that decision to be overturned.
So where does public opinion come down on this case? And where do you see the tipping point? What do you think is going to happen?
I think a lot of people in Britain are just sort of waiting for the outcome rather than having a strong feeling on where the exact law lies. But the really interesting thing about Richard III is that he continues to evoke these very deep, almost reflex feelings in people. So one of the important things about Richard is that he's generally talked about as England's last northern king. He spent a great deal of his life and the years before he became king ruling the north of England on behalf of his brother, Edward IV. And there's still a huge fond memory attached to the idea of a king who came from historically Britain's poorer and less advantaged part of the country. So there's a huge affection, a feeling that he's one of us up there and he should come home. Whereas if you go to Leicester, let's say, in the Midlands, which is where Richard died, there's more of a feeling of, you know what, you don't always get to choose how you want the story to end. And he died in a battle that he obviously didn't want to die in, but that's the way it ends up sometimes, and we need to reflect this sort of awkward reality of history in the decisions that we make. I think, personally, reporting the story, it was such a unprecedented case. We've never found a king that we lost for 500 years before. I think when we dug up Richard III, people simply didn't know how to act. And officials in the city of Leicester and academics at the university have actually followed procedure as closely as they could all the way through this. And they feel that they shouldn't have to change their plans or really answer to anybody. But the truth is, when you have an event of this importance, I think you do need to just maybe stop and throw it open and talk to people and listen to their views and listen to people like the Ricardians, who have incredibly strong feelings around this man. And in a funny way, I'm not sure the final decision about where he gets buried matters that much, as an opportunity for people to discuss their feelings and to be heard and to sort of, I don't know, take part in this event, which continues to sort of strike a chord with a surprising number of English people.
Sam Knight, I want to thank you for filling us in.
Pleasure.
Sam Knight, a journalist living in London. You can find a link to read his article for Prospect magazine called "Where Should Richard III Lie?" on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for spending some time with us today. Word of Mouth's Rethink 2014 series is nearing its end, but don't fret. All of the conversations and stories are compiled on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This week, we're going to wind down the series with rethinking the way we talk about and approach death. along with considering some new paradigms for radio. If you like what you heard, please share it with others or continue the conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. We're also on Twitter at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please do join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.